Americans disappear. Come, F-105s and T-28s, we will fire at you until you are destroyed. Well, this was the song that they sang in Laos. Laos, of course, a much more people with a much greater pacifist tradition, of people who are much more bereft of physical resources, even than the North Vietnamese. And certainly anyone who has visited North Vietnam, talked with their people, reacted to their toughness, to their dedication, has no doubt that they will continue to fight on. And so the question is, why has Nixon done it? Well, his stated reason is to secure the North Vietnamese submission to his demands on the peace agreement. Well, this is a very complicated question, and I'll just briefly discuss it here by saying that there is a peace agreement, a peace settlement. It was agreed to by both sides as of October 20th. The White House has never denied that. The message that Nixon sent to Pham Van Dong saying that, quote, the peace agreement can now be considered complete. And it's important to remember here that this peace agreement that was settled by the end of October is in no way a victory for the North Vietnamese, as I.F. Stone and other commentators have pointed out. It represents, at best, a very minimal kind of settlement for them, which will allow afterwards them an equal shot at unifying Vietnam. And of course, the North Vietnamese remain ready to sign the agreement. Well, so what's the obstacle? Well, of course, the obstacle is that after agreeing to the agreement, Nixon reneged and posed new conditions. Of course, the White House denies that they posed new conditions, but in fact, Henry Kissinger actually stated this in his press conference on December 16th, just before the newest bombing began, when he said that on November 20th, when they first returned after the elections, he said, quote, "We presented our proposals, some of which were accepted, others were rejected." Close quote. Now, these proposals, as high administration officials have been quoted in newspapers afterwards as revealing, as well as the North Vietnamese, basically centered around the Nixon administration's demand that DMZ be officially recognized as the dividing line between South and North Vietnam. Well, this gets, of course, to the very crux of the war. This gets to the crux of the American contention that Vietnam is not one country, and that it has a permanent right to intervene in South Vietnam indefinitely. As the New York Times reported on November 30th, quoting high administration officials who said that they believe that the, quote, effect, unquote, of the agreement to a DMZ would be, quote, to reestablish by law two separate Vietnams. Well, it's clear from this interpretation, quote, unquote, of the agreement to a DMZ that the North Vietnamese cannot, will not accept this change in the peace agreement. That for them to accept it would mean surrender, would mean betrayal of what they regard as a 4,000-year struggle to see their country free and unified. And so that Mr. Nixon's bombing will not achieve what he says he intends to achieve by it. He will not break the will of the Vietnamese. He will not force them to accept the agreement. And, of course, he will not achieve any significant military objectives, which, to close, is precisely why people in Washington are beginning to pose ugly questions, still whispered, but questions which have never been before been quite asked. To put it gently, people are beginning to wonder if Mr. Nixon's immense power has not gone to his head, taken him out of touch with reality, if he hasn't become unbalanced, irrational. It's a frightening question, but it's a question that ultimately only we can answer, because whatever is going on with the president, the only thing that will stop this current atrocity is the strongest public reaction from peace groups, from concerned individuals, from Congress. And if we don't stop this, if we don't react as never before to this saturation bombing of a city of 500,000 to a million people, I'm afraid that the long-term consequences will not only mean the destruction of Indochina, but the destruction of dozens of other third-world countries and ultimately our own democratic system.
Come, you masters of war, you that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, you that build all the bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind disks. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy, you play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes, then you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won, you want me to believe, but I see through your eyes and I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fasten all the triggers for the others to fire, and then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud. You've thrown the worst fear that can ever be hurled, fear to bring children into the world, for threatening my baby, unborn and unnamed. You ain't worth the blood that runs in your veins. How much do I know but to talk out of turn? You might say that I'm young, you might say I'm unlearned, but there's one thing I know, I'm younger than you. Even Jesus would never forgive what you do. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find when your death takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul. I hope that you die, and your death will come soon. I'll follow your casket by the pale afternoon, and I'll watch while you're lured down to your deathbed, and I'll stand over your grave till I'm sure that you're dead.
That report was from Fred Braffin of Project Air War in Washington. Music by Bob Dylan.
with representatives of North Vietnam and the Provisional Revolutionary Government of South Vietnam about the current massive bombing and the status of the peace negotiations. Tonight, WBAI is preempting Grassroots of Music to broadcast a live interview with Tom Hayden and Jane Fonda from WBCN-FM in Boston. Here now is Charles Lacudera from WBCN.
Baffled about Nixon's announcement today that he was stopping the bombing of Hanoi and Haiphong. A lot of people have been calling about that. The Paris peace talks would resume now, next week. What do you make of all that?
We hadn't seen the news, and it's hard to comment on that. It could be a 1 or 2 day bombing pause, but the essentials of the situation are the most important things to concentrate on. That Nixon has now committed a war crime that ranks him in history with Hitler and others. Not that his previous crimes in Indochina didn't do that, but those who said that George McGovern was extreme for comparing him with Adolf Hitler now had better revise their judgment. He is doing this because he thinks that the American people won't care, that the people of the world won't care, and he's doing it strategically to try to negotiate from strength with the Vietnamese. And my own impression from being in Hanoi recently is that no such military coercion will affect the Vietnamese except to increase the sufferings that they've already suffered. It's wrong to think that this bombing of the cities of Haiphong and Hanoi is like the bombing of Coventry, Lidice, Guernica, Hiroshima, Nagasaki. I see that many people are making that comparison. It is a comparison that's valid in the sense that innocent people are being massacred, but Hanoi is not Hiroshima. Hanoi calls itself in its editorials a city of human dignity, and that's because the people there have built and continued to build a system that defends them, protects their lives, and allows them to survive. If Nixon thinks that he has committed the equivalent of Hiroshima and now all he has to do is go to the negotiating table and get the Vietnamese to surrender, he's in for a very, very rude awakening.
One of the things, there's so much to say about what the turn that the war has taken, and it goes far beyond whether the bombing is stopped today or what Nixon's next move is going to be to try to manipulate American public opinion and world public opinion. We're going to have to try. I mean, all of us are going to have to try to figure out some way to talk to each other about, first of all, what it means. I mean, what it means to be using B-52 planes carpet bombing a city. These are planes that fly 5 miles in the air. They can't see their targets. They carry 30 tons of bombs each, and they're bombing populated areas. I mean, it's a.
And they're saying it's being caused because planes are being shot down.
But I think that something that's very significant is the fact that on Christmas Day, 400,000 people were quietly and in an organized fashion evacuated from Hanoi. Now, you have to think this is a city. There are no cars. People either walk or they ride bicycles. It's a poor country. It means that every family has to decide how they're going to divide up their mattresses and their mosquito netting and how the children are going to be dispersed into villages and how they're going to be able to go to schools that are scattered about so that they'll be harder to hit by the planes. And they didn't run out of the city. That's not panic. It's not like the city that's now under earthquake. They didn't trample each other in horror. It was an organized evacuation. They will simply empty out Hanoi. Nixon, in committing this act that is now put him up there in the ranks of Hitler and the likes, can destroy the city. But there are peasant people. There are people who don't rely on cities, and they'll just move into the countryside. And I think it's really important to think of that and to not just get bogged down in the horror of it. The shooting down of the B-52s, the fact that for the first time, the B-52 plane, which was considered this invincible monster, has been defeated. I mean, there are 100 combat-ready B-52s, and at least a quarter of them have been put out of commission.
Can I ask you something? I always wonder this. Why, if we bomb them, why don't they bomb Saigon? What has prevented them so far from actually dropping bombs on Saigon?
Because they expect that the people in Saigon are part of their liberation struggle.
Their own people.
And it's very difficult to find anyone in particular to bomb. They have shelled police stations in cities, shelled military bases, but not populated areas.
They don't bomb it for the same reason that they don't occupy it, that they don't take it over. They discovered in 1968 when the resistance in South Vietnam took back Hue, the city of Hue, the old imperial capital, and removed it from the control of the Saigon regime, they discovered that the United States military forces would not stop short of bombing. I mean, there was mass bombing in a city which took the lives of thousands and thousands of people, and they won't do that again. You know, they see it as a political struggle that is being carried on in cities, and they want to do things that will minimize the cost of their people's lives.
If you want to call, by the way, if you're in New York or Boston, the number here is 617-482-6410. I was sitting talking with Tom Hayden and Jane Fonda. Can you summarize briefly what went on at the peace talks before and after the American election? Right around the 7th of November, everybody... It was happening. One newspaper in Milford here had a front story headline, "The War is Over," and had to run an apology 2 days later. What happened? What was happening when Kissinger said the peace is at hand? What really was going on?
The impression that we have is pretty much the same as many people, that Kissinger felt that it was necessary to make that statement to keep the illusion of peace alive at election time, and no one could believe that such a big lie was possible. But actually, when we were campaigning in the Indochina peace campaign in New Jersey, we talked to a woman who was a refugee from Nazi Germany, and she said, you know, Hitler never convinced people with the small lies, but when he moved to the level of the big lie, it was impossible for people to... Yeah, and if you look at Kissinger's press conference on October 26th, now, looking back through the ashes of Hanoi, at that statement, you'll find that he said peace is at hand and that Radio Hanoi has correctly summarized the substance of the agreement. There were 9 points in the peace agreement, and he referred in substance to 8 of them. There was one that he didn't refer to, and that one was the most important. Point one, which says that the United States shall respect the independence, unity, and territorial integrity of Vietnam. In other words, Vietnam is one country. That should be the slogan of the peace movement, the understanding of the peace movement, the demand of the peace movement. The United States should respect the independence, territorial integrity, and sovereignty of Vietnam. And the meaning of that... important point goes to the heart of what's at issue in the war, because since the beginning, the United States has tried to create a Korea-type solution, separating the South from the North and creating a U.S.-supported dictatorship or regime in Saigon. And this point asserts the opposite proposition, that Vietnam is one country, that it was divided temporarily at Geneva, that the United States is now to respect the fact that it's one country. It means, in a practical sense, that the troops of northern origin who are in the South have every right, since they're Vietnamese, to be there. And the other part of the agreement that Kissinger never referred to in his summary on October 26 was that the U.S. was to recognize the reality of the Provisional Revolutionary Government, the PRG, what people here call the Viet Cong, as one of two administrations in the South who would combine and organize general elections. And the recognition of the PRG in the South would be the concrete way to guarantee you were not going to try to separate South Vietnam off and make it a U.S.-supported state. And in his press conference, those were the things he never referred to. He hasn't referred to them in his December 16th press conference. And if you ask, well, what's his strategy? It was told to a group of us who were in Hanoi very aptly by somebody. They said he's intoxicated with his electoral triumph. He thinks that the power of winning an election in America gives him power over Vietnam as well. And they feared that if he didn't sign the agreement before the election, he would come back through Kissinger intoxicated and try to rewrite the agreement, get new concessions guaranteeing that South Vietnam be within the American zone of influence.
Do you feel that there's a possibility that, it will be negotiated, some kind of an agreement will come?
I think a lot of that has to do with what the American people do in the coming period of time. Join together with the people, we can now say we're not talking in the abstract, but concretely, people from many, many countries around the world, most significantly American allies, allied countries whose governments for the first time are standing up and accusing the Nixon administration for carrying out war crimes and atrocities in Vietnam.
Sweden.
One of the things, Tom and I are here, in a sense, representing an organization that we work with that is across the country called the Indochina Peace Campaign. And we see the most important focus right now for all of us is pressuring to have the accord signed. Why? The accords represent peace. They represent compromises, equal compromises on both sides. They represent a face-saving end to the war for us. It's the only one we can have, and it's not going to be the end of the problems. There's going to be a long process afterwards in terms of rebuilding the country, ensuring that the accords are implemented and so forth. But the very first matter of business that we all have to do is get the accord signed. How do we do it? Well, there are many ways. Perhaps you could talk about some of the...
Especially since people are feeling so drained out, the Republican Democratic the election just drained everybody out. A lot of people just feel like it's worthless. Anything they do is just futile because Nixon doesn't care because he got this incredibly huge mandate, and all he has to do is he sits there and pushes these buttons, and all those letters are just the people that voted for McGovern. 30 million of them. He can afford 30 million people protesting. He can afford 30 million letters of protest, 30 million telegrams against him because he's got that other mandate.
But we have to protest for the sake of ourselves and the sake of our country and not feel drained, because if we don't protest now, imagine what it'll be like to talk to your kids or to talk to yourself in 5 years. I think that you never know how much effect you're going to have. But if people were as apathetic as you suggest, I don't think so many politicians, congressmen, even Republicans, newspaper editors, businessmen,
would be expressing the outrage.
Yeah. Even talking for the first time about pledging to cut off funds in Congress. Now, I don't think we should have any illusions that politicians of any party will end the Vietnam War, but they can end it if people really put on a tremendous amount of pressure. The first thing we have to do, it seems to me, is show that we do care, that we are not drained, because that's what's going to make Congress act, the feeling that the country cannot stomach or tolerate this thing any longer. One of the most moving things that we've heard about is that people have put together $250,000 already this week for the rebuilding of the Bac Mai Hospital in Hanoi. I visited the Bac Mai Hospital. Jane was there. Many people from the United States have been there. It's a huge hospital. where they have found a way to...
Limbs, graft limbs? Or
all kinds of things, but what I was going to say is they're able to even move the people 10, 15 times a day, the sick people, into shelters. And what's happened is that much of the staff has been killed under the bombing, and the whole hospital has been flattened. And Medical Aid for Indochina, a group that we work very closely with that's headquartered here in Boston, is helping with other people, including Ramsey Clark and a number of other people, to organize a Bach Mai Hospital Relief Fund and try to get together $3 million, not to compensate out of guilt or something like that, but to show our immediate solidarity that we are going to help to rebuild what the Air Force's bombs have flattened. We're not going to see our tax money go just for destruction. And this kind of compassionate reaction or feeling of solidarity is something that a lot of people can show through trying to work on medical aid to Indochina. And then the political matter is the signing of the agreements. We just had some meetings that are a little more optimistic than what you were implying. We had a meeting two nights ago that was called on one day's notice, and it was one of the broadest meetings. It had Liberal Democrats, People's Coalition, clergy and laity concerned, the American Friends Service Committee, the Indochina Peace Campaign, all kinds of people from national organizations rushing together in a spirit of unity to figure out what to do on the 3rd and 4th when Congress opens. There's going to be a convocation led by religious leaders, including a lot of the top religious leaders of the country, and a lot of pressure to have Congress stop the war by cutting off funds. And it's going to be followed by activities around the country, most of them decentralized, but a lot in Washington from the 19th to the 21st. In other words, the idea is to really show that we are still human and strategically put some pressure on Congress, because it's not just Nixon that has political power in this country, and from a grassroots level make such an impact that Congress has to go into opposition to the president on this question. It's the only thing that we can do. And at a grassroots level, it means getting out in the streets, collecting money for medical aid, giving out newspapers to explain to people the meaning of the peace agreements. We have a newspaper, a weekly newspaper called The War Bulletin, comes out of the Bay Area in California, giving out literature. We decided at the Indochina Peace Campaign meeting, where there were people from Los Angeles, Chicago, Detroit, Philadelphia, upstate New York. It was right here in Boston. We just finished 2 days of meetings. We decided to put tremendous energy into going into the communities with a lot of informational literature explaining the agreements, and with the idea being to get everybody in the community, every organization in the community, to put pressure on Congress to do something. Because now's the time when you can now's the time you can have a big impact. It's one of those moments you can have a big impact. And we'll continue till however long it takes to end the war, but this is an opportunity to have a big impact.
And for just to make it a little more concrete, because there is a new thing in the air now. I mean, people really, like our office phones are ringing all the time, and people say, what can we do? Come to 2 Brookline Street in Cambridge. Come to the office. Find out very concretely what kind of actions are going to be happening. If you want to get a hold of literature, if you want things to read to help us all understand more about the agreements, if you want petitions to take out into your churches or your schools or your places of work, all of these kind of things we can help get together for you. If you want to make contributions, send or come to 2 Brookline Street in Cambridge. And in New York, I'll give a phone number. The Cambridge phone number is 492-0489. That's 492-0489. In New York...
We understand we're talking to people in New York also right now, and people from many organizations, including the peace campaign, are going to be out all week in front of St. Patrick's Cathedral down on 50th and 5th Avenue, and it'll be like an outdoor meeting place where you can go and talk about things to do. I think the point is that coming to offices is all well and good, and calling up and making contributions is very important, but people don't have to wait for offices to take action on this one. You have right here, I understand, in this congressional district, a man by the name of Congressman O'Neill, who is going to be a very important person in the new Congress. And